This is the main entry, central hallway in between the auditorium and the library.
A local developer is giving one of our reporters a tour of an abandoned old school building on a hill on the west side.
It's been vacant almost, I don't know the exact number of years, but I think at least 20 years, if not closer to 25, 30 years. But the roof has failed in many places throughout all the buildings, so there's a lot of water damage, plaster damage. A lot of the original plaster work here in the auditorium is gone, and we'll have to try and recreate most of that best we can.
Is that what that kind of wet, musty smell is?
Yes, you're smelling water and some mold and just wet plaster and wet finishes.
Ah, yes, that musty old building smell. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about finding new uses for musty old buildings that have outlived their original purposes. When manufacturing dwindles, make way for new loft-style apartments and abandoned old firehouses, some people envision dance halls. But what about schools? What can they become? Steve McDowell is here to talk about that. He's the director of design at BNIM Architects. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. How about you?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Daniel Serta of Insight Design is with us as well. He's our go-to guy for all things urban planning. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Guys, what are some of the arguments in favor of repurposing old buildings when they've outlived the usefulness of their original purposes?
I think one of the most important things, and part of what you've seen happening in Kansas City, Missouri, is that those schools played an integral role in the life of those neighborhoods for decades. And the last thing anyone wants to see is a building being neglected, becoming forlorn, and becoming really an eyesore and blight within a community.
Is there anything in addition to just the aesthetic problem of an abandoned building?
Well, it's not just the aesthetic problem. I mean, the reality, particularly with schools, is that the reason the schools were closed reflects other processes of decline and change that are going on with the neighborhoods. And to have such a prominent physical marker of that decline, really sort of reminding everybody of it on a regular basis, there's a symbolic issue as well that's not just about the aesthetics or the architecture of the building.
Steve, what about you? What do you think you would say in favor of repurposing old buildings in general?
Well, there's a number of good reasons to do it. And maybe just to follow up on Daniel, this kind of began, is that the economics of the city and economics of the community is damaged, and in particular, the economics of school districts are damaged by schools that aren't doing their jobs. But the value of a building is much more than it's the cost and the resources that it takes to build it. It's value as a place, as a part of the community. And I think that the most successful rehabilitation or reuse of existing structures have really come from the community, much like the school in its original role was very much a part of the community fabric. And if you look at Union Station, what's happened there, turning a train station, a transit center into a museum, a chamber of commerce, a number of other activities.
Yeah, an event venue.
An event venue. And then later, the Bollander Center becoming a ballet school and a ballet headquarters for the company.
And what did that used to be, that space?
It was an old coal-fired building that generated steam and electricity that powered not only Union Station, but that whole precinct. And so, originally, in came coal, and out came two other refinements of energy, steam and electricity. I think today, in come people and their ideas and their physicalness, and out comes art and beauty and dance. And so it's kind of a nice transformation, I think.
What did it do for that neighborhood that transformation occurred? I mean, how long had those, with Union Station, that's a very prominent example, but the coal power plant that became a ballet school, how long did it take of that space sitting empty before that happened?
You know, I think the building closed in 1975 or 1976. The repurposing process for Union Station began in the mid-80s. The ballet looked at it. Well, actually, we worked on it first for Boulevard Brewery, then for our own offices, lots of different ideas. I think that it finally, the final kind of resurrection of the building took place over 6 or 7 years. It took a while, but it's turned out it was really the right thing to do.
When you talk about that you looked at it for different purposes, and it sounds like none of those quite worked, that gets me to this question about drawbacks and setbacks. I mean, if we're speaking really generally about repurposing old buildings, mm-hmm. what are some of the common either drawbacks or setbacks?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, people look at the condition. It was a coal plant, so it had a number of issues that frightened people. There had been asbestos there. There were probably some other chemicals and things like that.
Reasonable to be afraid of those things.
Reasonable to be afraid, but also very solvable, especially in today's world. But there were, you know, the building also just brought along with it some infrastructure that was purely designed to refine energy, to change coal into power and energy.
Like what? Can you describe some of it?
Just the shape of the space, the volumes of the space, a lot of the equipment that had been there that was no longer needed. We are the show me state, and it's hard at times to see things, to visualize things. But at any rate, it came with this burden of being next to a railroad track, which in some respects frightened everyone, and in fact frightened us when we thought about putting music and dance inside the building. But in fact, that old frame, those amazing walls, those really thick first growth fir window frames, we put some insulated glass in, we're able to isolate that noise and make that space really beneficial.
Daniel, I know that this isn't going to be a popular thing to consider, but are there ever compelling reasons to just let a building go?
Well, there always are. I think generally from a personal level, I tend to take the stance that letting a building go is okay as long as you do two things. First, your homework, the due diligence to determine that there really isn't a feasible alternative use for the building. And the second piece, which is probably even more important, is that there is a feasible future use for the site or the structure. I mean, if you're getting rid of the structure in particular, you need to know that there's going to be some really productive use of the site, because at the end of the day, it typically is a scarce resource that you're dealing with. And particularly with the case of schools and a lot of these other institutional facilities, you're usually looking at publicly owned facilities. And I think there's a general argument to be made that local government in particular and civic entities have more of an obligation to be good stewards of the space that they control.
We're going to get to the schools issue pretty soon, but I'd like to recap some of the major waves of repurposing that we've already seen in Kansas City's urban environments. What kinds of structures have been abandoned in kind of large numbers and then either reclaimed for a new purpose or allowed to crumble?
Well, the school district issue has been the most prominent, but I was thinking about this over the weekend. You go back decades. I mean, there's a whole range of these. There are some that are similar to the school district in the sense that there's been sort of a demographic attrition. So you have the archdiocese that closed down multiple parishes, for example.
When was that?
Over time. Mostly in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s. And so you have churches that needed to find new purposes. On a broader regional and national level, we have a few remarkable examples of this here, but there are other parts of the country where there are many more. The Postal Service has been decommissioning post offices throughout the United States. And in many cases, particularly in small towns and in some cases downtowns, like the post office in Midtown New York City that's slated to become potentially the new site of Penn Station, the sort of recreated Penn Station, the Moynihan Post Office, those are grand civic structures that in some cases have either been mothballed for decades or are literally threatened with demolition that people are actively trying to find alternative uses for.
What about old theaters? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, we've heard news about considering the Lyric building for a new YWCA, I believe.
YMCA.
You know, in the wake of new theaters like the Kauffman Center for Performing Arts and the Sprint Center, which is, you know, an arena type space, what does happen to these old theaters and what are some of the challenges to repurposing them?
Well, I think theaters are in some ways a more difficult animal, and the Lyric in particular. The Lyric was actually not built as a performing arts venue, even though it was used as the Lyric Theater for many years and used for the home for the symphony, the ballet, and the opera.
So it was already repurposed.
Yeah, it was actually a Masonic temple. And so it had a very unusual stage. The sight lines were totally different. The acoustics were not nearly what they should have been. And so a lot of adaptations have been made. But I think theaters as a whole, you know, coming, it depends how you look at it. The YMCA proposal really takes away most of what most of us would remember inside the building in order to put recreational and educational uses. So that's probably a stretch as far as repurposing. But I think repurposing fine arts theaters into other kinds of performance venues, into other media venues, which I think we'll see more and more of.
What do you mean media venues?
Different ways of incorporating digital media. Seems to be a trend of the kind of experiences that we as a culture are looking forward to. We're actually incorporating digital media in libraries in Georgia, in other places. And so I think it's one of the opportunities, learning centers, training centers, places to bring people together for different types of common good.
There was also, I think, a pretty big wave of factories and warehouses transforming into artist studios and loft apartments. How long did it take before that happened? Were those spaces that sat empty for long periods of time before that happened?
I think that that's probably been the most common reuse or adaptation of buildings into other uses throughout history, not just in Kansas City, but if you look kind of coast to coast, partly because it's really easy to do. You can just move in at some level and then different layers of intervention. It also accommodates many, many different uses within one structure, restaurants, cafes, galleries, living, workplaces, things like that. Just the kind of long life, loose fit nature of those buildings.
Long life, loose fit. I like that.
Well, it's an appropriate term. I mean, it's the way that those buildings really perform and recycle over life.
Would you say the same thing about gas stations? There's such a trend of gas stations turning into, like, restaurants.
I think they're important. I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think the gas station, you know, as it kind of evolved through history, started out as a place to buy gas, get your car fixed. It also served this role, and it still does in many small town communities, as kind of the local place to get a cup of coffee, to see your friends. It's a part of the community. In some respects, the fact that gas stations remain part of the community by becoming a taco shop or a pizza shop or whatever, you know, I think is, and it's not just in the U.S. We're headed to Recife, Brazil for a project, and I was guided to one of the best restaurants in the city is attached to a gas station, so I don't know.
Well, the gas station trend and what you were talking about before at the artist lofts, I think one of the important things to distinguish is there's a difference between smaller scale, private-led, adaptive reuse of those kinds of buildings, because there's a whole range of institution uses. One of the things I think is really striking even about the term repurposing is that part of what's created this conversation is the fact that in some cases we have an entire array of institutional buildings that all of a sudden are being taken out of productive use. And we've got a really dramatic challenge of how do we figure that out, as opposed to the sort of incremental, almost organic kind of, well, a building's not being quite used, or this person's going to step in here for a little while and maybe use it this way or that way.
Yeah, changes in the private sector.
There's private versus publicly led initiatives around this. And the reality is, too, particularly around issues like artist lofts, moving into manufacturing spaces. I was sort of tickled when Steve mentioned that, because I thought about an experience my wife and I had where we were looking at potentially leasing one of those spaces, and we were very lucky we didn't, because the building was torn down about 6 months later. But there's always the challenge of the market and the regulations that accompany that. And one of the things that often happens in crossroads-like areas is you end up with a regulatory challenge where city officials have sort of looked askance for a while at the fact that these buildings are used in ways that really technically are not legal, particularly as residences or as working spaces, live-work type spaces.
Not legal as in it's not zoned for that?
It's not zoned for that use is what it boils down to. Yeah. And then you can have really dramatic conversations around the future of a particular district, because there's a great deal of vitality there in terms of how those buildings are being almost organically repurposed by this person there and that person there and a whole range of people almost simultaneously.
Well, we are going to get to schools, but we're inching there by way of old religious structures, because that seems like it presents a similarly specific kind of architecture to repurpose. Have there been any examples of successful repurposing of old religious structures, churches or otherwise?
I think Loretto Academy in Kansas City was one that I think it's successful. I'm not completely familiar with the way it turned, that how it's worked over the change. Now it's kind of,
it's over on 39th
Street. I'd say it's more religious structure light as opposed to taking it, a church or a cathedral or something of that magnitude, because there were, the living spaces and all the other activities that were already part of the school. I think in other cities, one of my partner's brother lives in a repurposed church in western Kansas and has for about the last 15 years. There's, I think, a number of projects across the country, especially in areas where urban land is more valuable, and there are these abandoned buildings that they have been repurposed. But I'm less familiar with that happening in Kansas City on a large scale.
Well, progress on the repurposing of schools inspired today's conversation. Let's dive in on that for a while. Is there anything either of you want to say right off the bat about repurposing old school buildings?
Well, I guess I might begin with, I think that much like Union Station, there was a long community process about deciding about the fate of Union Station that led up to that happening, and that it was really important that Union Station continue to be, it was already part of the fabric of the community, and that however it was repurposed, that it remained that. And I think that that's one of the important lessons that we've learned in Kansas City. If we think, maybe not, I'll use a specific example, but the Bancroft School, for instance, and its work with Make It Right and others, was very much a part of a process that began with the larger neighborhood scale, when Brush Creek Community Partners helped the Manheim neighborhood go through a process to really revision what the neighborhood was going to be, to really begin rebuilding the sense of community, understanding what the issues really were. And through that process, which lasted 2 or 3 years, the idea for repurposing Bancroft came about. And really, that process helped shape what the needs were. That it was housing and other support services that were going to really help the community see their vision. I think that process, it's really important that the repurposing of schools really come from the greater community need.
Yeah, the issue is, as Steve mentioned, is process, and we have, as I mentioned before, this institutional challenge that the school district announces that they've got to close 30 schools. And you could take a very facile approach that says, well, we don't need these schools anymore. Let's just tear them down. But where you have the opportunity and you have the school district, I think, really putting themselves in the position of trying to be a better steward of those resources and seeing that the importance of those, that those buildings play in the life of those neighborhoods, to go through this process. And it hasn't been successful in every case of every individual building. It hasn't led to saving every single building. But there has been a thorough process in vetting alternatives and determining how they can fit into community aspirations.
Well, just to catch everyone up on exactly what we're talking about, 5 years ago, Kansas City Public Schools decided to close about half of its campuses to adjust to a shrinking student population. Kansas City is not the only district doing this. Detroit, Philadelphia, and Chicago also closed large numbers of school buildings in recent years. But in the wake of about 30 school closures, Kansas City developed what was considered a pioneering program, asking communities to be part of determining what would happen to the empty buildings. It turns out, transforming 1.8 million square feet of property has been a real challenge. Esther Honig has the story.
Shannon Jacks walks me through the old Blenheim School on the corner of Prospect and East Gregory Boulevard. She's the director of the Kansas City Public School Repurposing Initiative.
So for an elementary school, it's one of the bigger ones. It's almost 70,000 square feet. Our average for our elementary is closer to like 40, 45.
This building is 90 years old, but it's been closed for 14. There is paint peeling from the walls and all of the windows are boarded up, but you can still imagine kids running through the halls. We head downstairs to see the old gymnasium.
The gym And this building is in the basement. And so we have had flooding issues. But that's something that these developers are just really pretty, oh, I can see it now.
From where we stand, you can see the gym floor is flooded under 4 inches of water. The school security guard points out that a broken sub pump is to blame.
And the sub pump is on that side.
Yeah.
Still, Jax is confident the right developer for Blenheim is out there.
Yep. I will let the facility director know.
School districts don't often act as realtors, but in Kansas City, there are now 16 school buildings, including Blenheim, on the market. Since 2011, 9 have been sold and 3 have been demolished. For the remaining schools, maintenance and security cost the district $1.8 million a year. But the goal isn't to just sell them as quickly as possible. Jack says these schools are a public asset built with taxpayer dollars, so determining their future should be a civic process.
The school closures were very emotional and hard for parents, for families, for community members. We understood as a district the impact that we'd had by these closures, and that one way of addressing that was to, you know, find good viable reuses, give the community a voice as we moved forward.
Starting in 2011, Jax held meetings in every neighborhood with a closed school. Residents toured the sites, then said what they wanted to see done. As Jax expected, every neighborhood wanted their school saved. But factors like size, location, and condition meant that some buildings were more fit to be demolished than repurposed. And while many people wanted community centers and affordable senior housing, that meant finding developers who were interested in taking on those projects.
My name is Steve Fouch with Fouch Brothers. We are the developer of the Switzer West building. We're standing here in the main hallway of what we're calling the D building.
The old Switzer school on the west side has sat vacant for decades. The infrastructure is crumbling, and it's been the target of both vandalism and arson. Fouch estimates it will take $24 million to convert into 114 market-rate apartments.
The roof has failed in many places throughout all the buildings, so there's a lot of water damage.
Is that what that kind of wet, musty smell is?
Yes, you're smelling water and some mold and just wet plaster and wet finishes.
Then suddenly, we can hear voices coming from inside the building.
Do we have some?
We have some visitors.
In a second, he's on the phone with police.
Hi, this is Steve Fouch. We're with the Switzer School Complex, and we have kids that have trespassed into the school.
Vandals are a common nuisance in these buildings, and Fouch knows that. He's now restored 20 schools in small towns and cities across the Midwest. It's become his niche in the market. He says he can expect a low purchase price and the added advantage of historic tax credits. But the school repurposing plan in Kansas City requires Fouch to share his plans with the community, something not every developer has the patience for.
We have lots of meetings, and I try and work with them best I can, or other people try and get through to them on what their expectations are, and realizing that it's been here for 20, 25 years vacant.
Some residents had hoped renovations for the Switzer School would include more community space, or maybe a smaller parking lot. Fouch says he was open to the feedback, but at the end of the day, his plans have to be financially viable.
All of their expectations just can't be met. And if you want to see it saved, you have to give on a couple things.
Even empty, these schools still hold sentiment and an identity for a neighborhood, which means repurposing can be contentious. Residents in Waldo successfully fought plans that would replace the Bingham School with a Walmart grocery store. In the Northeast, despite the campaign to save the Thatcher School, it was demolished to create field space for another school. But in the Blue Hills neighborhood, you'll find the Cinderella story of school repurposing. Tonight, there's a dance performance at the new Mary L. Kelly Center, formerly Graceland Elementary.
Are you nervous at all?
Nah, I got this. When the music starts, you kind of know which song it is, and then you're waiting and waiting. And then it just takes off.
Teresa Smith is a student in the adult line dancing class, but she uses the center for other things too, like the computer lab and the gym.
Oh, it's great. I look on the website and I see all the things that the kids can do. You know, it's just amazing. See, coming up in my day, we didn't have anything like this, and it's free. I'm even taking a computer class here.
This former school has been turned back into a community asset, and that's the goal. But this repurposing had some advantages. The building was in really good condition, and the developers, a nonprofit called the Upper Room, had generous donors. But just up the street on 51st and Garfield, Willard Elementary is different. From their front porch, sisters Yolanda and Erica Hall can see the smokestack of the old school.
What do you feel like when you walk past the building?
Well, I drove by there a couple times and it looks scary.
Willard has been closed since 2000, and vandals have torn it apart, scavenging copper wiring and piping. Roof tiles fall and shatter on the ground, and the walls are marred with graffiti.
I just think it makes our neighborhood look bad because neighborhoods down here, they usually already have a bad name, and when you see big abandoned buildings that aren't being taken care of, it just makes it look worse.
According to Shannon Jacks, developers last year lost interest in this property because the cost to repurpose it outweighed the potential profit. If they can't find a use for it, it could be demolished. Jacob Wagner, a professor of urban planning at UMKC, knows the effect a building like this can have on a neighborhood.
They can cast a shadow over the neighborhood and people feel like it is bringing down property values and it's impacting people's perception of safety.
Wagner has been studying the reuse process in Kansas City since 2007 and says that blighted school buildings like this are still more valuable standing than demolished.
Even after, if you do demolish the building, you still have the challenge of managing a massive vacant lot. So that's another whole nother problem.
Wagner says that because there's no immediate market for these buildings, the best solution is to do a better job of preserving them so they can be reused in the future. Of course, that would require more money from the district. And that's money that's not being spent in the classroom. So for Willard and the 15 other schools in the district's portfolio, it's a race against time to find the right developer before another building is lost.
Esther Honig brought us that story. Central Standard is headed off to a break. When we return, we'll want to hear about your experiences with repurposed old buildings. If you live or work in a space that was originally intended for some other function, call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the quirks and challenges and share your ideas for those abandoned old school buildings. That's 816-235-2888. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with urban design guru Daniel Serta and architect Steve McDowell. We're talking about giving new life to abandoned old buildings. Hi again, Daniel.
Hi.
And welcome back, Steve.
Hi.
We've just heard the story of what's going on with several of the school buildings that were closed by the Kansas City School District a few years ago. One of the things we heard is that communities are really nostalgic about these buildings and emotionally attached to them. Can you explain not just why that is, but how it factors into how this is all going to play out?
Well, the explanation is pretty simple to understand. In a lot of neighborhoods, you have longtime residents that went to school in those buildings. They sent their children to school in those buildings. The buildings themselves are major anchors within the community. The challenge, as you heard explained by Steve Fauch, is that sometimes the ways in which the community would like to see the building saved or reused is really not economically feasible. And that creates a really dramatic challenge, and it can create a fairly tense process.
So it sounds to me like part of what goes on here is that the combination of limited resources and high expectations can create like a perfect storm of self-sabotage. Is there any way around that, or is that just kind of built into this situation?
I think part of the way around it is the process. One of the things I've seen happen in a number of neighborhoods, it's pretty remarkable. I had one of my neighbors said this to me once about an endangered historic building. She said, you know, I've stood here and watched it decline. I'd rather see them tear it down than see it continue to rot, which is a very paradoxical thing to hear somebody say. You know, on the one hand, they clearly have very strong sentiment for it. But on the other hand, it's almost like, you know, I'd rather see the building put out of its misery. That can become a real challenge because, as Jacob Wagner mentioned in that piece, sometimes what's needed is a strategy to manage and essentially mothball the building for an extended period of time, and that can really try a neighborhood's patience.
Steve, what about you? What are your thoughts about this whole issue of limited resources and high expectations?
Well, I think the issue is really more complicated because of the lack of nimbleness in our system to kind of react to changes in our city and our communities.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, it's in some respects, I think we all think it's the school district's problem, when in fact it's the whole community's problem, it's the city's problem, it's the county's problem. It's really all of our problem to kind of adapt and change to things that happen in our community, and schools in particular, and the buildings themselves. Which, you know, the school, the education that goes inside the school is one thing. The role the school plays in the community is something else, and in the buildings and the physicality of the place is something different. And, you know, I think that one of the reasons that we all get so frustrated is our forces of the community don't seem to align around addressing these problems when they happen. You know, the school district issues really surfaced for the first time in the late 60s or early 70s. In terms of when bond issues started failing and all the things that came along behind that. And so the school issues really 30-some years old. I think if we had a better way of being able to adapt to the changes in our community and address them right away, when instead of closing the school, maybe the plan should be to use a long life loose fit transformation that allows housing or some other need to go in very, very quickly.
Is there a community or a city where this is how it's done that you can point to?
Well, no, except I think that when Shawnee Mission closed some of their schools a decade or so ago, I think they much more quickly responded to using them for repurposing them, either for other schools, for private schools and so on, or for other uses. I can't be very specific. I just seem to remember that happening.
What's the significance of doing things quickly? I mean, I would think the longer a building sits empty, as we kind of heard in that story, you know, the more you open up the possibility for damage, flooding, all those kinds of things that don't happen when there aren't tenants, when things aren't maintained.
I think that in some ways the building is the least important part of it. I think it becomes a hole in the community. It becomes a hole in the economy of the city. Where it's not producing taxes in the first place, but as it declines, it starts lowering the values of the neighboring houses and neighboring community. And I think being able to be more responsive, to in a way having a proactive plan in place before something bad happens, is something that we ought to think about. And schools aren't the only issue in that area.
Warehouse lofts became available as manufacturing dwindled. What does it say about our own time that the buildings falling out of use are schools and churches?
Well, I think you could say that maybe that both schools and churches are home or house community, or at least some of our most important resources of community. And that could suggest that community is possibly on a decline, but I think it's probably the wrong time to be saying that, because I think, in fact, just the opposite is true. That community is actually is a huge rebound in Kansas City. It's one of our most important products and most important resources. And the fact that we're having this conversation, that the community is really trying to decide what to do with these assets that no longer serve their original intent or purpose, is a good thing.
You can't look at the school district in particular, or even the situation I mentioned before with churches, without understanding. We've gone through decades of people leaving the city, leaving urban areas. But as Steve said, part of what's focusing this conversation is the fact that now we have people coming back and people trying to find alternative uses for buildings that sometimes have been neglected or underutilized.
Is that partly because space is at more of a premium now, too?
That is part of it. But, you know, as I'm thinking about all of these and these different circumstances we've described, and some of the specific projects that Steve was talking about, like what is now the ballet building and the alternatives that were looked at for that, you need a certain degree of sort of a creative streak in folks to look at a building and see ways and be very imaginative in ways that the building could be reused. Now, again, that's not always something that's economically feasible, but you have to have a certain degree of being able to do that. The Crossroads is probably the best example in town of that. There were buildings there that had been neglected for decades, and that if there had been the resources, probably would have been demolished. But it took artists and others to come in and see what we now have.
You know, I want to talk to you about this creativity because school building structures are so particular. You know, you've got spaces intended for many people to go down long corridors to different spaces. So these long corridors, gymnasiums, auditoriums, cafeterias, just really particular purposes. What is the role of creativity and even, you know, serious problem solving in seeing a new use for these structures?
Well, the architecture sometimes can be a real challenge, and there's some real practical challenges. As Steve mentioned, they can be overcome if they're properly worked through. I think the issue with imagination is, you know, it's a scale of the intervention. I'm thinking of Wonderscope. When Steve mentioned Shawnee Mission School District, there's, you know, an old elementary school that was probably built in the 1940s or 1950s. Very standard design of the time, looks like a lot of elementary schools around the metropolitan area. And the museum that operates there now effectively operates in there as if though it's a museum in an elementary school. And there's nothing wrong with that. It works very effectively. If they had taken on a more grandiose plan of clearing everything out and creating a lot of open spaces, it might not have ever gotten off the ground. So sometimes the adaptability, both of the vision as well as the actual use, is part of the necessary ingredient in moving a project forward.
Call 816-235-2888 if there's an abandoned building in your neighborhood that you think could serve a useful new purpose. This is your chance to vet your idea. Our experts will let you know whether they think it's got potential. 816-235-2888. When you call, you'll be talking with Daniel Serta of Insight Design and Steve McDowell of BNIM Architects. Guys, I know someone who did repurpose an old school in a rural area once, and she was turning it into an artist retreat. Her major struggle was heating an entire school in the winter and air conditioning it in the summer. The gymnasium especially was a real problem. Can we talk about just the scale of these structures?
Absolutely. One of the things in terms of the architecture of a lot of these buildings is that they tend to have very high ceilings. Now, one of the interesting things, I'm intimately familiar with a particular schoolhouse in Kansas City, Kansas, because I actually used to live there. And if you look at the original design, the architects took that into account in the 1920s when they designed the building. They selectively did not place windows on certain faces of the building so that it wouldn't be drawing light into the building and creating heat and trapping heat inside. The ceilings were high in part because before air conditioning, the primary way that you circulated heat through, basically evacuated heat out of a building was through convection. You know, have trams and windows up high that the heat could escape through. But in current circumstances, those kind of spaces, as you say, can be really daunting to deal with. One of the things that often works for those kinds of projects is to selectively, essentially, mothball different parts of the structure, not use different aspects of the structure to make it a little more manageable in terms of your carrying capacity, your ability to meet those expenses.
Michael from Ottawa, Kansas, called to share, "We have a repurposed school in Ottawa, Kansas. It's now apartments for seniors. It's declared a historic building, and the apartments still have blackboards in them, and it seems to be flourishing. Is that a suggestion that's come up and gotten any traction in Kansas City?"
Oh, absolutely. Steve Fouch has mentioned before the Horace Mann School in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, is exactly that kind of project. An older project, Northeast Middle School, done in Kansas City, Kansas, I think back in about 1995 or so, the same kind of thing. It was repurposed specifically for senior housing. One thing I will mention about that, it's a side note, it's a technical note, but it's an important thing to acknowledge, is that it's not uncommon to see schools and historic buildings repurposed not just as housing, but senior housing specifically, and senior housing as an historic building. Because what developers are able to do then is what they call stacking, which is where they're able to draw on not only historic tax credits, but also sometimes low-income housing tax credits. So you have essentially public subsidy helping make those projects feasible from an economic standpoint.
We have a tweet from Linda. It's a question. She wants to know, what are the liability concerns with these vacant buildings? Are these buildings covered by insurance? I've heard it can last sometimes no longer than a year. So that is an interesting question with these structures that we heard kids are breaking into. I mean, who is responsible for these spaces?
I think the school district is, and that's one of the issues. I mean, so it's costing them every year they're paying insurance payments and then probably deductibles when things happen for a building that's really not serving a purpose. It's drawing down the economics of the school and something that the district then something needs to be addressed.
It's time for another break. We'll have just a few more minutes for this conversation about repurposing old buildings. We'll jump right back into that in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined by urban design specialist Daniel Serta and architect Steve McDowell for a discussion about repurposing old buildings. We've got some callers who want to join in, so let's get right to them. I'd like to speak with Imani. Hi, Imani.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks for joining.
Thank you. I have been trying for quite some time to turn the building in the 18th and Vine area, I don't remember the name of the school building, it was an old elementary school, into a bed and breakfast, as well as a retail space. The incubator space in the Lincoln building is completely full. You cannot get in there. They have no more space for business incubators, and that's what I would like to do with that building in that area.
So let's hear about that. What do you think about turning a school at 18th and Vine into either a bed and breakfast or sort of an entrepreneurial hub, an incubator for new businesses?
Well, both of those are the types of uses that those kinds of buildings have been put into. I'm not terribly familiar recently with the conditions or the circumstances of that. I recall looking at that probably 20 years ago when the Jazz District was first being put together. I know there have been active proposals for that. One of the challenges that often exists beyond the obvious of financial feasibility and the condition and that sort of thing is a question of how that type of project fits into the larger vision for an area, and that I'm not terribly familiar with.
Well, I would think that it fits quite well. I mean, the whole idea of increasing tourism in the district, there's probably stories that could be told about the school as it relates to the history of the district, but both those uses are, I think it was retail / incubator and bed and breakfast, those uses are pretty malleable, and so I have a feeling that those uses could be slipped into the building structure without making huge changes and really allowing the building to maintain its historic integrity so that historic taxes could be applied for and achieved so that the economics start to work out.
Let's talk to Alan in Leavenworth. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
What's your...
What I wanted to add... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you. I'd like to hear your suggestion.
Well, the oldest synagogue in the state of Kansas, which is located in Leavenworth, believe it or not, was turned into apartments, which are just beautiful and maintain the historic nature of the building.
Can you talk about, when you say they're beautiful, what are some of the physical characteristics?
They're as modern and nice as any modern apartment I've seen, and they're very, very reasonably priced. So we get Middle America going in them. And another example, I spent a year in Little Rock, and there was an old Orthodox cathedral, not a huge one, but a larger one, that was turned into apartments. And one of the drawing points to each of these buildings was the stained glass windows that stayed there.
Well, we've got just limited time, so I'm going to let our guests jump in here. What are your responses to hearing this story? Is it a project you're familiar with?
I'm not familiar with either one, but I know that in particular, Leavenworth is a very, very rich architectural town, and so I can imagine it's really a wonderful project. I think the idea of stained glass probably works both ways. People in really like to be able to look outdoors in their living units. And so I think it sounds like they've really, at least in Little Rock, achieved in a kind of balanced environment that people have that opportunity as well as enjoy the windows.
We have just a minute left. And so, Daniel Serta, could you quickly tell us where geographically are some of the greatest repurposing opportunities in Kansas City?
Geographically?
Yeah.
Well, I think in the core parts of the city where you're seeing real interest in neighborhoods coming back, there's barely a part of the urban core you can go to that you don't see buildings that are sitting there sort of shabby and edgeworn that couldn't find new life as some really interesting, invigorating use within the neighborhood.
So that's Daniel Serta with us from Insight Design. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Steve McDowell, principal at BNIM. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Before we say goodbye for the day, we'd like to explore some forgotten branches of a colleague's family tree. KCUR's Maria Carter recently discovered that there might just be a reason that Wyandotte County feels like home.
I grew up a Missourian. I never really thought I'd live in Kansas. My parents fled the Johnson County suburbs for the Missouri Ozarks after I was born. And as a kid, I played in the forests and creeks near my house and listened to Cardinals games on the radio. Family vacations almost always included a cave tour. And thanks to fourth grade Missouri history, I could still recite the official Missouri state bird, bluebird, flower, hawthorn, and mineral, galena, in case you were wondering. When I got a job in Kansas City, I moved to the Missouri side. It seemed like that was where I fit. I was young, single, and worked in Missouri. But when it came time to buy a house, I fell in love with one in Wyandotte County. Not far from the side of the family I knew least about. Most of my Kansas roots are in Johnson County.
I gotta go down and walk my dog a little bit. We're in the motorhome.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And my doggie's down there.
It might be a little hard to hear, but that's my grandpa, Jerry Carter, talking. I remember him as a retiree in a motorhome with his dog Bart and my grandma Joyce. Not as part of the fabric of businesses, as he recounted in an oral history for the Overland Park Historical Society.
Can't think of the guy's name. He and his wife opened the Scogbo Gamble store in there. And they only had that for a couple of years. Their dad took over their inventory at a price he could afford. And went in there with a sports shop.
And the sports shop was Carter Sporting Goods. And before that, they had a grocery store a few doors down. Of course, by the time my parents were kids in Shawnee Mission schools, Overland Park was in the middle of a growth spurt. More houses and stores were being built. And of course, more change was coming. When I was a kid visiting relatives, my parents would point at strip malls and buildings, wowed by what had grown up to replace cornfields. On the other side of my family, I also had roots in Johnson County. My grandma grew up on a farm in Gardner, Kansas. And in a reversal from current McMansion trends, she says her family chopped off part of the house when they bought it because it was too big. So I knew about these roots, but one branch of the family tree has been more of a mystery. It's the Wyandotte County branch. My grandfather died when my dad was only 11 years old and decided the family that already had loose family ties became a little looser. Talking to a great uncle a few years ago, I realized I lived not far from where he and my grandfather grew up in Rosedale. Today, their house and street are gone, taken up by the ever-expanding KU Med, and it seemed like my family history had been wiped out, until on a walk I stopped by the Rosedale Memorial Arch. And there among the names of Rosedale soldiers who died in war was a familiar last name, Corbin. It was another great uncle, Emmett Corbin. He died in World War II. I see kids and families in my neighborhood every day, but there, reading the name of a long-forgotten relative, that's when it hit me that long ago, one of those families was mine. Kansas City, Kansas feels like home now, and it's hard to say why exactly. Maybe it's history. Maybe it's being close to my aunts, uncles, and cousins. Maybe it's being able to legally set off fireworks on the 4th of July. And maybe it doesn't really make sense when a place feels like home, but sometimes it just does.
Maria Carter is our news director, and she's living proof that we can cross those boundaries between Kansas and Missouri and between Wyandotte and Johnson counties. That's all the time we have for today's shows. To listen back to any of today's discussions, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have everything you heard this hour posted for your enjoyment by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and continue the conversation on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, in honor of our incredible bi-state spelling bee champions, Central Standard is all about playing with words. Vanya Shivashankar will be with us. Don't miss it tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today's discussion. The standard has been set. Stick around for Up to Date next.